Hey, good afternoon, everyone. It's good to see you all today. Well, I would like to take you back to the time when the internet was brand new. Now, for some of you, that might be hard to picture. You remember it well, or it might not be hard to picture. Others of you perhaps cannot imagine there ever being a time when the internet did not exist. But one of the things that became popular in the beginning were chat rooms and discussion forums. I don't know if the popularity of chat rooms are still a thing. I think that was a bit of a flash in the pan, you know, the idea of going into internet chat rooms with total strangers and just having random conversations about anything. It was a neat novelty at the time, but I think the idea had become somewhat silly rather quickly. You know, forum discussions, on the other hand, are still a thing, where you can actually put up posts on various topics and get feedback or debate. I still participate in a few online forums, although I'm doing so less and less, as I realize, you know, even in Church of God forums, it's hard to build a relationship with people when you can't engage them face to face. There's only so far you can go with an online-only relationship. I have a few online friends that I've known for many years, but again, it really doesn't seem to get much traction in terms of a meaningful relationship. You know, the idea of the Internet Church of God where people just stay home and fellowship online. I don't know if there are still some people that prefer that option. It seems kind of shallow to me. Now, this past year at the feast in Jamaica, I ran into a fellow that I had interacted with quite a bit going back to the 1990s. We were among the minority in a forum that held to views that I would call United Church of God doctrine. You know, he's a deacon in Kingston, Jamaica, and I spoke in Jamaica, so he must have seen my name on the roster, and he tracked me down. Now, for many years, you know, perhaps decades, we would have each other's backs in support of our beliefs in these forums, and then we finally got to meet face to face. And even there, in this unusual case of a decades-long acquaintance, I would say that the relationship wasn't made complete until we could actually look into each other's face and shake hands. But anyway, I digress. You know, I want to take you back to the beginning of all that. 1995, perhaps 1996, the concept of the Internet Discussion Forum was popular. Now, what else was significant about 1995? Well, I think most of us here could think of some Church of God history that was going on in 1995. You know, what a coincidence that the doctrinal upheaval happened right about the same time as people began to mass communicate together in a way that was unprecedented. Never before in history have people been able to do that. And suddenly everyone was getting information in real time. I think that may have sidelined some people who had long-term plans for how they wanted to ease in doctrinal changes into the church. So anyway, I set the stage for you. 1995, 1996, United Church of God is a brand new organization, and we have a new technology called Internet Discussion Forums, where people are still hotly debating many of the issues. I'm participating in one particular forum where a person comes in, they introduce themselves, himself or herself, as someone who is brand new to Christianity, a brand new convert. No Church of God history, brand new to studying the Bible, and just happened to come across our forum and thought he or she would join up and share in the discussions. Now, her first post, I think it was a she, if memory serves, so we'll just go with that. Her first post was to introduce herself and tell us how she was a brand new Bible student, and she had some questions. She was wondering, among other things, that if we're keeping the Sabbath in the holy days, we're observing the laws of clean and unclean meats, etc., then should we be wearing tassels? And do we wear tassels? And if not, then why not? And I recall just being dumbfounded by that, that would be one of the first questions that a brand new student studying the Bible would come up with. You know, I replied to her post in astonishment. You know, I first welcomed her to the forum, and then I said something to the effect of, "You mean to tell me that you just started reading the Bible, and your first question is whether or not Christians ought to be wearing tassels? That just boggles my mind." You know, I was perhaps years, you know, maybe a decade into the church before I even knew what a tassel was. It's not the first thing that comes up in Bible study, for sure. I'll tell you what was the first thing that came up for me. You know, if your right hand offends you, cut it off. If your right eye offends you, pluck it out. To be honest, that passage offended me. And rather than plucking out my own eye, I almost came close to plucking out my Bible and tossing it into the trash can. But you can see how that would be something that a new Bible student would question. It comes up early in the Gospels. Most people begin in the Gospels, right? So you're going to get hit with the controversial words of Jesus Christ first. You know, but tassels? And again, I told this person how amazed I was that that was her first question that popped up in reading the Bible brand new for the first time. Well, as it turns out, another member of the forum wasn't quite as naive and gullible as I was. I had no reason to doubt this person's claim. You know, I took her completely at face value. But this other member replied and said, "Oh, I can assure you, Lynn, this is not a new student of the Bible. This is most likely a long-time church member who went along with the changes, and they're here to troll us." So I was introduced to the concept of an internet troll. You know, I had not heard that term before. But apparently this is when someone comes into your group, it infiltrates your group, and they have an agenda. They're not here for honest dialogue. You know, they're trying to trap us and thinking that we can't possibly respond. How would we answer a sincere, brand new Bible student with such a question, you know? So it was a tactic, and it was trying to trip us up. And again, I had no idea what an internet troll was. You know, I had no reason to doubt this person. But this other person called her out publicly, and before we could get into the discussion, the other person quickly withdrew from the forum. So either she was quickly offended by the accusation of being an internet troll, or she was, in fact, an internet troll. So either way, she dropped out of the forum, and we didn't see her anymore. Well, I've had nearly 30 years to think about that question, and now I'm ready to give you the answer. So the title of the sermon is The Tassels Question. We in the United Church of God believe that we should keep God's commandments. So let's turn over to Numbers chapter 15. Numbers, the 15th chapter, there is a commandment in the law pertaining to the wearing of something called tassels. Should we be wearing them? And if not, then why not? So let's begin then with the reading of the commandment in the law. You know, we'll get an introduction to tassels. This isn't going to be difficult because the word tassels only comes up a few times in the scriptures. Oh, I went too far here, so there we go. Numbers chapter 15 and verse 38, we're introduced to tassels here. So verse 38, "Speak to the children of Israel. Tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations and to put a blue thread in the tassels of the corners. And you shall have the tassel, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Eternal and do them, and that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined, and that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy for your God." Okay, so let's take this passage apart methodically. There's a little bit to unpack here. We'll start with this word tassels. The Hebrew word is spelled S-I-S-I-T, and it's, bear with me here, it's pronounced tzitzit, 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 let's just go with that, tzitzit. So it can be translated as tassel or fringe, as the authorized King James Version would translate it. It calls it a fringe. So the word fringe might be a little more helpful to us when we imagine a garment that has a fringe. Now, this word occurs four times in three verses of the Hebrew scriptures, and three of those are right here in Numbers chapter 15. The fourth usage is found in Ezekiel, where the prophet describes being carried up in vision by the hand of God, where God takes Ezekiel by a lock of his hair. So, and that word is tzitzit. So perhaps if we imagine a lock of hair and compare that to what a fringe of a garment might look like, we might get a sense of what we're talking about. So we're talking about the fringe of a garment. Okay, let's go on to Deuteronomy chapter 22, and then we're going to find another word for this, and it might elaborate a little bit on the type of fringe that comes off of a garment. So Deuteronomy chapter 22, let's read verse 12. "You shall make tassels on the four corners of the clothing with which you cover yourself." So here we have a different word that is translated as tassels. The Hebrew word is spelled G-A-D-I-L, and it's pronounced Gadil, Gadil. And it's defined as twisted threads. The word is used here in Deuteronomy and then in one other place in 1 Kings, where it's used to describe a wreath of chain work. And the word wreath is Gadil. So you can picture the twisting of threads or cords to make a wreath. Now here in Deuteronomy, not only does it say the corners of your garments, it says the four corners of your garment. So that poses a slight problem for me to imagine. Our clothing can't really be described as having four corners. You know, so we're sort of left here with having to use our imaginations a little bit. I think we can imagine a square bolt of cloth, or perhaps a rectangle. It has four corners, and perhaps it works as like a robe, or maybe a poncho of sorts. The bolt of cloth is created by weaving strands of thread together. And if you've ever seen cloth being made by weaving, you know, I grew up near Amish country, and I've been to the county fair, and I've seen old-fashioned devices out there where they actually were weaving cloths to make large bolts of cloth, or blankets, or whatever. Now, if you've seen that, or if you can imagine that, you can picture a cloth that is made from weaving strands of thread. They're weaved together to form the cloth, and when you get to the end, somehow you would have to tie off those ends, or, you know, perhaps create a hem of sorts, and that's going to prevent the cloth from unraveling. And if you don't trim those ends, what do you have remaining at the end of the garment? Well, you have fringes. Now, is that what we're talking about here? A square bolt of cloth that functions as a poncho-type robe. It has four corners, and at those corners, there are remaining strands of thread that can be described as fringes. We are then commanded to twist those fringes in a decorative sort of way, perhaps braided or intertwined like a wreath, to create something that we would call the tassel. The threads of the fringes are already there, so the command isn't to create the fringe necessarily. The command is to make the fringes decorative in a certain sort of way to make the tassel. All right, so let's go back then to Numbers chapter 15. And Numbers chapter 15 there has a command that it doesn't just tell us to twist the threads in the end to make a tassel. It tells us to do something else. So let's look at that again. There's something else that's going to make this decorative fringe more special. Let's notice that in verse 38. Speak to the children of Israel. Tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations and to put a blue thread in the tassels of the corners. So now we have an additional element to consider, the blue thread. Let's go to the Hebrew word for blue here. The word is spelled T-E-K-E-L-E-T, and it's pronounced tekeleth. Okay, I did the pronunciation thing on my computer Bible, where, you know, you can click on it and it gives you the pronunciation. I'm not going to attempt that here because it's this guttural sound, tekeleth, you know, so it's like, I'm not even going to try that. So let's just go with tekeleth, okay? So I don't speak Hebrew, so, a couple other languages in the world kind of use this guttural, way of speaking, but we're not going to do that today. We'll just call it tekeleth. The definition is the color blue, and it covers the spectrum between red through deep purple. So this is describing a certain dye involved in the coloring of fabrics. Now, hence you have a blue thread intertwined with the fringes of your garment. Now, understanding the process of how fabrics were dyed in ancient times is going to explain a lot of what's going on here. Dyed fabrics were extremely rare and expensive in ancient times. The product for creating the dyes was harvested from a certain type of snail found in the Mediterranean. And this is the murex snail shell that was most commonly used to create the tekeleth. You know, isn't that absolutely gorgeous? Could you imagine finding that on the beach? Now, that's just beautiful. Those colors are just fantastic. So this is where tekeleth comes from. It was a difficult and tedious process that required a lot of snails to get a very small amount of dye. So now I would like you to imagine a world where colors are largely non-existent. My son Matthew says that colors weren't invented until way past my era in the 1970s and 1980s. But Colors were largely non-existent in the ancient world. And certainly you have colors in nature. You have blue skies, you have colorful flowers, but to create colorful fabrics, you had to use dye. You couldn't soak a garment in blueberry juice or grape juice, for example. That's not going to work. All that's going to do is accomplish, is going to have a garment that has stains in it. And stains typically wash out. You know, some stains might be difficult to wash out and become permanent, but not in an attractive sort of way. A wine stain in a shirt doesn't suddenly make that shirt an attractive shade of purple. But dyes permeate the fabric. And with manufacturing dyes being very difficult, very tedious, very laborious, practically speaking, no one owned dyed fabrics in the ancient times. Certainly not the common class of people. Fabric was typically made from wool or linen. Now, there is a commandment, of course, not to mix wool and linen. So you either had a wool garment or you had a linen garment. So a wool garment is made from animal fibers like sheep. And you can imagine a wool garment being basically white. And garments without spot and blemish can be described as being white as snow. They are given garments that are white as snow. The linen garment was made from plant fiber, specifically flax. I don't know exactly what shade of color a dry linen garment would be in its natural state. I'm assuming the color spectrum would be from light beige to perhaps brown. I have one example here that, see if I can get that. There we go. So garments worn by the common people would be white to beige to brown. It's basically colorless and drab. But the four corners of the garment, in the four corners of the garment, God required that every Israelite take at least a thread of blue and intertwine that with the fringes on the four corners of the garment. Now, what is the significance of that? What is the purpose? Let's go back to Numbers chapter 15 again, where we were. Hopefully, you probably held your finger there. Numbers 15 and verse 39. And you shall have the tassel that you may look on it and remember all the commandments of the Eternal and do them. And that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined. So there you have it. That's clear as can be, right? Painfully obvious. You get up in the morning, you throw on your garment, you look down at that fancy tassel, it's hanging from each corner, you see the blue thread in the tassel, and you think to yourself, I need to keep God's commandments. Oh, how love I thy law, it is ever with me, because of the blue thread. Well, I don't know about you, but for me, that is not at all clear. It is not painfully obvious. Why should a blue thread remind me to keep God's commandments? Is it just a random memory device? If so, you know, couldn't I just pick any random object as my memory device? I'm going to twist a bread tie around my little finger, and every time I see that bread tie, I'm going to remember to keep God's commandments. I suppose that could work. No, we're going to look at this a little bit deeper as we get into this. The blue thread in the tassel is an icon that's going to point to something else. And in that society, it would have been painfully obvious, and it would have been clear. The Hebrew word to caliph occurs in 49 verses in the Hebrew scriptures, and 40 of those verses occur in Exodus and Numbers, where the instructions are given concerning the construction of the tabernacle in the wilderness, and the establishment of the Levitical priesthood. So let's look at a few examples and turn to Exodus chapter 38. Exodus, the 38th chapter. Here in Exodus, we're given the instructions to build the tabernacle in the wilderness. And again, I want you to imagine a world where everything as far as the eye can see is essentially colorless and drab and brown. We're in the Sinai Desert. We've got rocks, we've got dirt, perhaps some scraggly looking plants are sprouting up here and there. You know, I know some desert terrains can be different from others. You know, the Sonoran Desert, for example, in Tucson. I'm sure many of you have been to Tucson for the feast. That's actually quite a colorful desert as far as deserts go. It certainly has a beauty to it, you know, as far as deserts go. I haven't been to the Sinai Desert, but I'm picturing it as an essentially brown and lifeless looking place. The color spectrum is perhaps shades of beige to brown. Our clothing is essentially in the spectrum of white to beige to brown. And if you had a garment made from the wool of sheep, you know, while it may have started out as white as snow, it probably wasn't that way for very long as you traveled through that desert. So everything is brown. Now imagine coming across this marvelous structure known as God's tabernacle in the wilderness. And let's get a brief description of part of that here in Exodus 38. And we'll start reading in verse 18. The screen for the gate of the court was woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread and of fine woven linen. The length was 20 cubits, and the height along its width was 5 cubits, corresponding to the hangings of the court. So picture in your mind, you have this tabernacle. It's 100 cubits long on the north and south side. It's 50 cubits long on the east and west side. And on the east side, you have a gate in the center. It's 20 cubits long. And on each side of the gate is 15 cubits each. So 20 cubits in the center, and that's the gate. Now, a cubit is the distance between the tip of the middle finger down to the elbow. And it comes to about 18 inches. I tested that measurement on myself, and it came out to 18 inches. And interestingly, I had my son Ryan helping me with that. He did the measurement for me, and then we measured his distance. And it came out to 18 inches, which I found amazing because we're 4 inches different in height. You know, he's 5'7", I'm 5'11", but the distance between our middle finger and our elbow is 18 inches on both of us. So is that an extremely accurate measurement for... That tends to work out for most adult males, that we have 18 inches in length for a forearm. I don't know, but it's interesting. Either way, a cubit is about 18 inches. So 20 cubits is 30 feet long. 30 feet long. The gate on the east side has a curtain of cloth. It's 30 feet long, and it's about 7.5 feet high. My yard fence is about 7.5 feet. Maybe it's 7 feet. So you know what your yard fence looks like, right? So the passage says 20 cubits long and 5 cubits high. So the height is 7.5 feet. A fine woven cloth, 30 feet long and 7.5 feet wide, high, and it's dyed into kaleth. That's just one curtain. If you were to look at all the trappings surrounding the temple, you'd find all kinds of quality items that would just make this entire structure, it's a literal jewel. Sitting in this brown, drab desert. It's half the size of a football field. And this thing would glisten with bright colors. You could probably see it from miles away. Now, if that small piece of cloth... Now, if just one small piece of cloth dyed in blue, let's say the length of a scarf, if that would be an extravagantly costly item that practically no one could afford, imagine the cost of a 30-foot by 8-foot cloth. Imagine what that would be. How much would it cost to make such a thing? The amount of snails it would take to harvest and process the dye to make that one hanging on the east gate of the tabernacle. The thing would be essentially priceless. Fantastic thing to behold. Let's go to Exodus chapter 39. One chapter over, Exodus 39. And certainly if you wanted to read more about what was involved in the construction of the tabernacle, and to just try to imagine in your mind's eye what that must have looked like, this fantastic jewel just sitting in the middle of the Sinai desert. Oh, you can read about that in Exodus and Numbers. There's a lot of detail there, and while, you know, some people might say, oh, you know, that's maybe not as an interesting portion of the Bible, but I find it fascinating. So read it with that in mind. It's thinking how fantastic this construction would be. But here in Exodus 39, we have the instructions for the garment of the priesthood. So let's start in verse 1. Exodus 39 and verse 1. Of the blue, purple, and scarlet thread they made garments of ministry for ministering in the holy place. And they made the holy garments for Aaron as the Eternal had commanded Moses. So they're not going to just get a blue thread to put in their tassel on the four corners of their garment. Their garments are going to be made entirely using these priceless dyes. Let's drop down to verse 22. He made the robe of the ephod of woven work all of blue. The entire robe of the high priest was made with dyed cloth using tekeleth. The entire robe. You've got a single thread in the tassel with this costly to Caleb that is something very special for the common Israelite. But the high priest has an entire robe made out of Tekelith, among other costly things of gold. And, you know, you've got the bells made of gold, you've got pomegranates, and, you know, you've got a crown of gold. Notice that down in verse 29, just drop down to verse 29. And a sash of fine woven linen with blue, purple, and scarlet thread made by a weaver, as the Eternal had commanded Moses. Then they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold and wrote on it an inscription like the engraving of a signet, Holiness to the Lord. And they tied it with a blue cord to fasten it above on the turban, as the Eternal had commanded Moses. So now again, picture this. Here you are. You're an average common Israelite, and you behold the high priest in his garments from head to toe. He's decked in blue and purple and scarlet. He's got gold and precious stones. His entire outfit, again, you know, here in the brown and drab Sinai desert, it's just a fantastic thing to behold. It's priceless beyond measure. Now, I took you through that long description of the tabernacle and the priest for a reason. Let's go back to you waking up in your tent. You throw on your garment. It's a basic garment of flax linen, essentially beige or brown, the same color as everything else around you, you know, your tent, your blanket, the dirt under your feet. But there in the four corners of your garment, the fringes are twisted with a ribbon of blue, a blue thread, and it forms the tassels. You look on that blue thread, and like an icon, it brings to your mind, it represents that you are a commandment keeper of the God of Israel. It is a brightly colored icon that points directly to what? The beautifully constructed tabernacle and that highly decorated high priest. And no matter how poor or lowly a citizen of Israel you are, you have at least that one ribbon of blue that connects you to that system. So logically speaking then, if the thread in the tassel points to keeping God's commandments, and it's an icon that points to the tabernacle and the high priest, then logic states that looking on the tabernacle and the high priest also points to keeping God's commandments, right? Isn't that basic logic? And resisting the temptation of idolatry and religious harlotry. Now, why is that? Why would looking on that structure, or that high priest, why would that remind you to keep God's commandments? Well, let's dig just a little bit deeper. Let's turn over to Jeremiah chapter 7. If I were to ask you, when did that system come into existence? The Levitical administration. When did it come into existence? Your response might be, well, when Israel came out of Egypt. But notice what the prophet Jeremiah states here in verse 22. Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 22. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. So here it appears that Jeremiah would disagree. God did not have the Levitical system ready to give to Israel when they came out of Egypt. Let's jump over to Exodus chapter 19 to see that. Exodus 19, verses 1 through 6. By the time Israel came through the Red Sea, you know, we're several weeks between the days of unleavened bread and Pentecost, Israel is approaching Mount Sinai. They're essentially coming out of Egypt as they approach Mount Sinai. And let's notice what happens. Start in verse 1, Exodus chapter 19 and verse 1. In the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. For they had departed from Rephidim, had come to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Eternal called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will construct an elaborate temple, tabernacle, and set apart the Levites to perform elaborate ceremonies and rituals to me. No, it doesn't say that, does it? Verse 5 again. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. This is what Jeremiah is talking about, isn't it? Israel was to obey the voice of God, the commandments that God was about to speak. And of course, what follows Exodus chapter 19? We have Exodus chapter 20 and the giving by the direct voice of the God of Israel to the people. We have the giving of the Ten Commandments. It's actually going to go on through chapters 21 through 23 to give other instructions, including the annual holy days, right? So that was not part of the tabernacle system. That was part of the original plan to have holy days, where we see that this was God's original intent for Israel. The covenant was ratified in Exodus chapter 24, and this is what Jeremiah is talking about. Now, what we don't have there are the instructions for the tabernacle and for the Levitical administration of law. So what happened where that got thrown into the mix? Well, you know the story, don't you? Moses went up to the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and during that time, Israel sinned a great sin. They constructed a golden calf and said, "This is the God that brought us out of the land of Egypt." Let's turn over to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians, the third chapter. So what follows the golden calf incident then is Exodus chapters 25 through 40. And if you were to read through that entire passage of scripture, that would describe the adding to the law and administration of law. It came into existence at Mount Sinai. It didn't exist before. It was 430 years after Abraham. The tabernacle in the wilderness with the Levites to administer was an addition to the law. It was added to the law. Exodus 40 states that it came into practice a full year after that time that Jeremiah describes, or he states, "For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you." Notice Galatians chapter 3 and verse 19 here. What purpose does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions. What transgressions? The golden calf incident, which followed the original ratification of the covenant, which did not have the Levitical administration attached to it. It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator. Now, a mediator does not mediate for one only, but God is one. Is the law then against the promises of God? Certainly not. For if there had been a law given which could have given life, truly righteousness would have been by the law. But the scripture has confined all under sin, that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would be afterward be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. So the tabernacle, that beautiful, dazzling jewel in the desert, with its ornately dressed Levite priests, it was given because of sin, and it was a tutor to bring them to Christ. So they looked on that tassel, those fringes on the four corners of their garment. They looked on that ribbon of blue within the tassel, and it reminded them to keep God's commandments. Why? Because it was an icon that pointed to the tabernacle and the Levitical system. The tabernacle was there as plan B because of sin. You know, as beautiful as that tabernacle was, when they looked upon it, they should have thought, wow, we have sinned. Every day they looked on that tabernacle, that should have been their thought. We have sinned. And now we have this elaborate Levitical system to remind us of this every day. So when I look at that system, when I see that icon of that system hanging from the four corners of my garment, I need to think, keep God's commandments. That's why looking on the blue ribbon in the tassel is a reminder to keep God's commandments. And now comes the question that we've been waiting for. Why don't you and I, as Christians, wear tassels? We believe in keeping God's commandments. We believe what Jesus Christ said in Matthew 5, that not one jot, not one tittle will pass from the law. We believe the Apostle Paul when he told the Romans that we do not make void the law through faith, but on the contrary, we establish the law. And yet, I don't have a decorative fringe with a ribbon of blue hanging anywhere on my garment. I'll answer that question in a moment, but first, let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22, we've got a law here in the 22nd chapter of Deuteronomy, and I wonder how many of you here are breaking this law. Until heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or one tittle will pass from the law. We believe that. Words of Jesus Christ. So let's see if the jots and tittles of Deuteronomy 22 have passed away. Verse 8, Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse 8, when you build a new house, then you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring guilt of bloodshed on your household if anyone falls from it. So how many of you have a well-constructed parapet on the roof of your house? Anybody? I don't see any hands. I've got to be honest with you. My house, I've lived in it for 17 years, and I don't have a parapet. Now, what is a parapet, you ask? Glad you asked that. I don't think it's hard to figure out. Apparently, it's something to keep people from falling off of your roof. So perhaps it's a type of it's some type of guardrail. You know, people walk out on your roof and there's a protective rail or perhaps a 3-foot wall that's going to keep you from falling off your roof. I don't have it. If we invite any of you over to our home, well, guests beware. Because when you go out on my roof, you're not going to be protected. Because I'm guilty of neglecting Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse 8. Now, why don't I have a parapet on my roof? And why, I'm assuming, don't any of you? Some of you might. I don't know. Well, because we don't entertain guests on the roof of our house. This is not a law that has any application for us today. Not in the direct sense, because the style of our homes are much different than those in the ancient Middle East. People went out on the roof probably just like we would with our own decks and our own patios. So the law of the parapet was to make sure that the homeowner didn't put their guests and their visitors in danger. They were responsible for the safety of those who came into their dwellings. And there's no direct application of this law for us today because we don't entertain guests and visitors on the roofs of our houses. Our general style of architecture doesn't even allow us to do that, to go out on the roof, you know, even if we wanted to. But does that mean this law is done away? No, of course not. Do not think that Jesus Christ came to destroy the law. He did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. He came to magnify. And so what is the magnification of this law in Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse 8? Well, the magnification is that we are responsible for the safety of our guests when they enter our dwellings. If you happen to be able to go out on your roof with your guests, well, you need to have a parapet to keep your guests from falling off the roof. If you have a raised deck in the back of your house, you know, maybe the drop off of your deck is several feet to the ground. You know, if an elderly person came over and fell off of your deck and you didn't have safety precautions in place, then you would be guilty. We had a large, beautiful maple tree in our backyard. I love that tree. Maples remind me so much of where I grew up in Pennsylvania. To have a big maple tree in my backyard rather than some nasty pine dripping sap tree, it was just such a delight to have. I loved that tree. It provided a fantastic shade covering from the afternoon sun. Well, about 3 or 4 months ago, we started to see limbs falling from that tree. Lots of dead branches were hanging off. At one point, a large branch fell and hit my wife's car, and it was large enough that it took out the windshield. So what we did was to prune off as much of those dead branches as we could find. But then we started to see live branches falling off the tree. You know, branches with green leaves still attached to them. And soon we started to note that the whole tree just looked sickly. And we had an arborist come out, take a look at the tree, and she confirmed that, yes, your tree is sick, it's dying, it needs to come down. But still, I was in denial. I thought if I could just prune it back some more, you know, maybe I could save that tree. But the more we thought about it, you know, we looked at those major branches that were hanging over our house. A few major limbs actually extended into our neighbor's property. You know, our neighbor has children. Now, what if, with me already knowing that the tree is sick, I've already been told by the arborist that it's terminal. The tree has to come down, but I continue to stay in denial. I refuse to cut down my precious maple tree. Now, what if a large branch falls and kills one of my neighbors, kills one of their children? Deuteronomy chapter 22, in principle, suggests that I have a responsibility to make sure my home and my property is a safe place. If a tree branch fell and killed my neighbor from a tree that I knew was sick, according to God's holy and righteous law, I would be guilty of murder. And in ancient times, they would take me out back and stone me to death because of it. The law of the parapet is not done away. It is fully in force. But the application of the law in the letter doesn't work because we don't have the same kind of roof that they had in their architecture in ancient Israel. So there are commands given in the law that simply have no application for us today to do it by the letter. But it is not done away. We just need to find out the principle behind the law and keep it in that way. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter. Here we're going to see the Apostle Paul quote from the law. He's going to use a law that probably has no direct application to the members in Corinth. But instead, he's going to infer the principle out of the law. So he's going to teach us how to do this. We look at the law. It has no direct application, but we're going to draw out the principle. So let's notice 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 1. Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, yet doubtless I am to you. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. My defense to those who examine me is this. Do we have no right to eat and drink? Do we have no right to take on a believing wife, as do the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working? Whoever goes to war at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit? Or who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man? Or does not the law say the same thing also? For it is written in the law of Moses. For it is written in the law of Moses to the Gentile congregation in Corinth. It is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Now, is it oxen that God is concerned about? Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? So notice how he uses the law of Moses as an authority in the Gentile congregation. You shall not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain. Corinth, a metropolitan center. You know, Dallas is a metropolitan center. Probably very few, if any, own oxen. And if you do, you're not using them to tread out the grain. Certainly today, we don't have too many people doing that. But what does Paul say? Is it oxen that God is concerned about? Or does he say it for our sakes? So the law of not muzzling the ox while it treads out the grain is an illustration that supports the principle that a person is worthy of their hire. They are worthy to receive a fair wage. In this case, a person working full-time in the ministry to preach the gospel is worthy to be supported financially by the church. That's the principle that Paul drew from that. You know, I can't obey this law in the letter because I don't own an ox, and I don't have any grain that needs to be treaded out. I do have employees in my business, and I am morally bound to give them a fair wage. I have a church that financially supports its full-time ministers, and I have an obligation to do my part in helping support that ministry as well. Let's bring this back to the tassels question. I'm standing before you, and I have to admit, I don't have fringes on the four corners of my garment with ribbons of blue intertwined in them. Am I breaking the letter of the law? I would like to point out to you that I am covered in various shades of blue. So everyone notice that? So everything I'm wearing, I've got a blue suit, I've got a blue shirt, my tie is blue, I've got blue socks. I can see that right there, I've got blue socks. Now, at the risk of too much information, I'm going to tell you, I have blue underwear. I promise you I do. And that was intentional. I did that on purpose. In honor of giving a sermon on Tekeleth, I wanted to be completely covered in various shades of blue. This blue tie is dyed with the finest Tekeleth harvested from thousands of Murex snails, and it's worth about $10,000. No, that's not true. I got it at JCPenney for 12 bucks. But nevertheless, I'm completely covered in blue. Doesn't that just shout out in the most glaring sense, keep God's commandments? You know, here I am. Is that what you think of when you see me covered in blue, is keep God's commandments? Probably not. Because just like the law of the parapet, the letter of the law has completely lost all meaning in our society today. Clothing dyed in the color blue has no connection to anything. There's nothing special about dyed fabrics in our society. The process of dyeing fabrics using synthetic means versus organic was invented in 1869, and that is essentially what put an end to colorful fabrics being anything special, anything rare, anything of extremely high value. So that fact alone suggests that the command would be meaningless for us today. So why don't I wear tassels? Well, let's make a list. One, I don't wear a square bolt of cloth with four corners to create the fringe at the end. Nothing we wear in our society even resembles anything that could be described as having four corners. Four corners. So even if I had a Tekeleth ribbon, I wouldn't know where to attach it if I wanted to remain faithful to the commandment in Numbers and Deuteronomy. And no, hanging a cord on my belt wouldn't cut it for me, because that's not how the law instructs us to make the fringe. Notice here on Amazon, this is a screenshot from Amazon.com, you can purchase four modern-day tassels, or tzitzit, for $6.55. These are approved by, I guess they're called kosher, they're approved by rabbinical Judaism to be used as tassels. A cheap piece of junk for $1 and change each. I was actually going to buy these so I could pass them around in the congregation while I was giving the sermon. But then I changed my mind because, one, I ran out of time before I had to have this sermon ready. And two, what's the point? What would be the point? It's essentially a worthless piece of yarn. There is no way that this is the equivalent of the ancient tassel. Even if you convince me that I ought to be wearing tassels, this is ridiculous and absurd. I'm not going to wear that. And that brings me to my second point. Number two, we don't use Tekeleth to make blue dyed cloth. We have synthetic dyes that allow us to have colored fabrics so readily available that they essentially have no real value. Not in the sense of anything like royalty or a priestly class would wear. Again, if this blue tie were made of dyed Tekeleth, having a garment this large, completely made of Tekeleth, would probably be a small fortune. But instead, it's a $12 piece of fabric. It's actually a $50 piece of fabric. I went to JCPenney yesterday to get this, and it was on sale, 50% off, and it said $50, and so it was marked at $25. Well, then when I got up to the register, they gave me another 50% off, and I got it for 12 bucks, so 75% off. That was pretty awesome. But the blue thread in this modern tzitzit costs less than a dollar. Blue cloth is simply meaningless in our society today. Point number three, we don't have a tabernacle system or a Levitical administration in place. So even if I did have a ribbon of Tekeleth that I can intertwine with the fringes of my four corners of my square poncho, which I don't have, even if I did have that style of a garment with that rare ribbon of blue, it wouldn't connect to anything that would link it to keeping God's commandments. Even if I had the exact replica of what God intended for the tassel to be made from, the proper garment with the proper Tekeleth ribbon, it would still be meaningless without the Levitical system in place. For that ribbon of blue to point to, for me to be reminded daily, keep God's commandments. Now, all those reasons I have given basically fall into the category of law that I simply cannot apply in the modern age. Just like the law of the parapet and the law of muzzling the ox, trying to force the letter of the law in this situation would simply be meaningless. You know, I could construct a parapet on my roof if I wanted to. Have a nice guardrail or maybe a concrete wall about 3 feet high. We'll do the whole perimeter of my roof. You know, what's stopping me from doing that? I can do that. At least then I wouldn't be guilty of violating the letter of the law, right? Who cares if it has no practical function? Who cares if it does nothing to protect the guests who come to my house? I've got a guardrail on my roof that no one walks on. It'd be meaningless. Just as wearing a ribbon of blue tekelet on my fringe of my garment would be completely meaningless as well. Now, did you notice I haven't used the argument of, I don't need a physical reminder for keeping God's commandments since I have the Spirit of God in me. I could use that argument, and it would essentially be true, but I'm going to tell you why I prefer to shy away from that explanation. The idea of having God's Holy Spirit negates the need for physical reminders. It's a flawed New Testament argument, and one we ought to be careful of. It's a slippery slope when we take that position. Hey, why do you put leaven out of your homes during the days of unleavened bread? Well, it's a physical reminder that we do annually to remind us of the necessity of putting sin out of our lives. Oh, that's interesting. Well, I don't need a physical reminder to do that, to put sin out of my life, because I have God's Holy Spirit, and that reminds me of that 24/7. I've heard that argument back in 1995. I almost fell for it. I actually did fall for it for a time. My wife did not. She never fell for it. But there was a period of time where I was like, oh, you know, it's more important to focus on the Spirit rather than, you know, so. Anyway. Hey, why do you wash each other's feet in the annual Passover service? Well, it's a physical ritual. It's symbolic. We do it every year as a symbolic act, and it reminds us that we need to serve each other in the way that Jesus Christ served his brethren and taught us to serve the brethren. Oh, that's interesting. Well, I don't need a physical reminder to do that, to serve God's people, because I have God's Holy Spirit. It's in me 24/7, so I'm just serve God's people 24/7. God's Spirit reminds me to do that. You see the problem with the logic, right? The New Testament has physical rituals. We are physical beings, and we live and learn by doing physical things. Water baptism is a physical ritual. Anointing with oil is a symbolic act. Putting out the leaven, washing each other's feet, drinking a small amount of wine, or eating a square of unleavened bread on that Passover evening service. These are physical symbols that illustrate spiritual truths for our physical brains, our physical minds. We're physical beings. Having the Spirit of God does not, by default, do away with physical rituals. So yes, you could state it that way, that we don't need that physical icon to point to keeping God's commandments. And that is correct. We don't. We don't need the tabernacle system. It's gone. We don't have that anymore. But that is not the primary reason I would give for why I don't wear tassels. Let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, and as you're turning there, let's recall that passage that we already read in Exodus 19, where God states, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." God is telling this to each and every Israelite, from the lowliest servant through the middle class commoners all the way to the kings and the priests. He's saying each and every one of them were a special treasure to him above all peoples, and they were to serve as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Their conduct was supposed to reflect that calling through devoted obedience to God's holy and righteous law. They slipped up. They fell away from that. So God gave them another system. And the blue tekelet ribbon in the tassel pointed to the law that every Israelite wore like a badge of honor to connect them to that system. But let's read 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people." That sounds familiar, doesn't it? You're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but now are the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the visitation. The question of why I don't wear tassels today is as meaningless to me as why I don't have a parapet on my roof. There's simply no way to apply the law in the strictest letter to where it would have any meaning whatsoever in our lives. But we are a chosen generation. We are a royal priesthood. And Peter tells us that as a result of that consequence, of that calling, we are expected to have honorable conduct. We are expected to abstain from fleshly lusts. We are expected, of course, to keep God's commandments. And yes, of course, it's through God's Holy Spirit that we are reminded daily to keep God's commandments. We don't have a tabernacle to look at. We don't have a temple. We don't have a Levite priest dressed in fantastic robes. But we do have God's Holy Spirit. And what does that Spirit do for us? You don't have to turn here. You can if you want to. But I'm going to finish the sermon by quoting from Romans chapter 7 and verse 25. I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then with the mind, I myself serve the law of God. Wearing tassels may no longer be applicable in our society, but serving the law of God in our minds, well, that's certainly applicable in every age.